House Committee on Revenue for February 28, 2018 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues. We're going to open the work session on Senate Bill 1529. Colleagues, well, do you want to give us an update on the Dash 20?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 1529 with the Dash 20 amendment is what we have up there in Olis right now. And Chris is going to walk through the repatriation discussion. But just as a reminder, the underlying bill was the those connection point in time updates to the Internal Revenue Code. And then Chris will pick it up from there.
Great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So we're going to try and save Kyle's voice here a little bit.
Ah, didn't realize we were having a problem with
sick?
That.
Okay, so the Dash 820 is largely similar to the amendment discussed yesterday, with a different direction for some of the funds. But just to walk through the Dash 820, the changes start on page line 25 of Senate Bill 1529A. And so referencing the 820, lines 1 through 9 make the language clarification for the repatriation dollars being put into the IRC. The drafted version of the bill specifically referenced IRC 965, which is where we expect these deemed repatriation dollars and dividends to show up in the IRC. But out of an abundance of caution, the language is being changed to more broadly to refer to the entire federal legislation, so that if the IRS, for some reason, places those into a different point in the code, we're not back here replicating the same mistake. And so that is the same from the other day. Lines, beginning with lines 10 down through the bold language that is the new sections 31A and 31B, is the destination for these repatriation dollars. So that's on the order of $140 or $145 million estimated right now. And this language lines up with the funds that are in the process of being created in Senate Bill 1566. So this language creates those funds and deposits the money, the repatriation dollars, into those funds as spelled out in that language. So that part is different from the amendment you discussed the other day. It's a different destination for those repatriation dollars. So then turning to page 2 of the A20 amendment, the next change appears on line 11, which refers to page 27 of the bill and deletes line 4 and 5. And that is simply deleting the applicability section of the main bill. Rather than renumbering it, it's getting deleted there. And then lines 12 through 18 on page 2, that's section 37. This is the same language that you saw the other day. It requires the DOR to do a report by December 1, 2020, comparing the efficacy of the tax haven law, which is ORS 317.716, and the new federal provisions of GILTI, the Global Income Low Tax, Global Intangible Low Taxed Income. So they're going to produce a report on those two policies. And then section 38 is the new applicability. It just got moved. So it's largely what you heard the other day, just the destination of the repatriation funds is different.
Thank you. All right. This doesn't have a subsequent to Ways and Means.
Correct.
All right. Okay. All right.
So we do have fiscal statements and revenue impact statements.
Right. Okay. Representative Smith Warner.
Mr. Chair, I move the
Dash 20.
Sorry, there's so many dashes. Thank you. The Dash 20 amendment to Senate Bill 1529A.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves the Dash 20 amendment to House Bill or Senate Bill 1529A. Discussion. Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to share with the committee and with the public, Senate Bill 1529 is a piece of legislation that, for the most part, I can get behind and support, but I'm concerned with the A20 amendments, and let me share with you and with everyone else my rationale. I'll soon be
finishing up 18 years in the legislature, much of which that time has been spent in Ways and Means. And if there's one lesson I've learned in Ways and Means, it's you want flexibility in funding. And right now, revenues are an all-time high coming into the state of Oregon. Many programs are, worthy programs are being funded. But the reality is, like all good things, it will soon come to an end. The economy will begin to slow up. We'll find ourselves in a situation of having to make difficult decisions. And while there's no doubt in my mind the public employee retirement fund that we're talking about, I apologize not using the correct term on that, but the concept is worthy, I think it takes away from our flexibility and our ability to prioritize as needed when times arise. And I believe those times will soon be coming. And so with that said, I'll be a no on the A20s, dash A20s.
Thank you. Further discussion? Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say I have great respect for my colleagues' experience and knowledge, and I do want to be clear that this bill in particular relates to one specific part of the tax code that is an expected one-time-only fund. It is a one-time-only receipt, and at a time when we are at the highest level ever in our rainy day fund and others, I believe that it is the most responsible thing we can do, because it is a one-time short-term, is to move this money towards dealing with our longer-term first situation. So,
thank you. Representative Bueller?
Question, Sharon, you may not be able to answer, but what happens if the employer incentive fund is not drawn upon by other public employers?
I think that what happens at that point is that the eagle eyes in the Ways and Means Committee will find another use for the fund and put that in a budget bill. Is that an accurate statement? Yes, I'm getting a head nod from Representative Smith. This sort of allocation is subject to change by law until the money's actually spent, I think. Is that right? Yes. I'm getting another head nod from Representative Smith. Other questions? The debate. Representative Bueller, please.
Just comment. I mean, I feel strongly that we have to address our unfunded liability in our PERS system. I think we all understand that. Continuing to throw more money into the system without asking for meaningful and impactful reforms, I think, is not fair to Oregon taxpayers. I also think it's not fair to continue to fund public employee pension plan while lots of people suffer, vulnerable people like foster kids in this state that we should be taking care of, that it's been clear two audits now in 2 years' time that there is severe problems, underfunding, nearly 700 positions unfunded. I think this money would be better served going to the Child Welfare Division than to funding the PERS liability at this point.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I think this body did go through a good process of due diligence during the 2017 session, particularly over on the Senate side, to try to look for some savings in PERS. We went through a long list of possible reforms and came up with very little. And that is because the courts have really told us that we can't change the obligations that we made to retirees in the past. We are stuck with the bill. And while we need to continue to look for those, and I think we did pass one very small piece of legislation, but a good one, during this session that addresses PERS obligations, in the meantime, we've got to figure out how to pay for it. And I think this is of great concern to people across the state. I don't have a public meeting where someone doesn't ask me about PERS and what we're doing about it. It has risen to a point where we have a widespread concern over the fact that we have bills that we don't know how we're going to pay. So now we have a one-time, call it windfall, money that's not obligated to something else. And I think the opportunity to set it aside in PERS accounts with the potential for really addressing issues, particularly in the K-12 schools, is a very responsible thing to do. Is it enough money to fully impact that? It's a beginning. And I think you don't establish a fund and you don't begin to pay down those liabilities till you take the first step. And so I fully support this effort.
Thank you. Representative Bueller?
So the question, Chair, and I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask this to. So where will the funds come from the local public employers to be matched by this newly created public employee retirement incentive fund?
You're right in your supposition. I don't have the answer to that question. I do know that there is a significant amount of work going on in another committee on a bill that I believe is Senate Bill 1566 on exactly the question you're raising. I have not been involved in the conversation about that bill, and so I don't know the answer to your question.
I understand it had come from our local school districts, so those funds normally would go towards classrooms, kids.
Right. And of course, the Ways and Means Committee and in its work on the state school fund will consider that as an issue as they address that question. And again, that's not within the purview of anything that I've been working on, so I don't know the answer. I would make one additional comment, and that is because this is one-time money, it's important for us not to put the state and the Ways and Means Committee in a bind trying to use one-time money to fund processes that need to be ongoing in order to do it. We face a deficit, according to Representative Nathanson, in a private conversation we had, I think, yesterday, that in 1921, we're facing a deficit, projected deficit of $1.3 billion, and that could, of course, be off by a couple hundred million either direction. Being prudent, putting the money into something where we're not ramping up some program may make some sense. And a committee, we're going to we will stand at ease. Do not wander off. I hope. Right. Committee will come back to order. The motion on the floor is the dash A20 amendment to Senate Bill 1529. Is there further discussion? Objection to the motion? Oh, better call the roll, please.
Representative Bueller?
No.
Representative Findley?
No.
Representative Hernandez?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Yes.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Breschke?
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
No.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith Warner?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1529A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Oh, I'm sorry?
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves Senate Bill 1529A to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Representative Smith, please, and then Representative Bueller.
Yeah, actually, I defer to Representative Bueller.
Representative Bueller, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to move the amendment A17.
Representative Bueller moves the amendment A17. To your amendment, to your motion?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I feel strongly that we're having a significant misplaced priority here, that we're putting funding of a retirement plan, which is in desperate need of fixing, of amending, to put it on a more stable course, without doing that kind of work and allocating more dollars, I think, is not responsible at this time. On top of that, we have the misplaced priority where clearly there is lots of foster kids in this state who are struggling mightily. And that's just not me calling out. That's two separate years that there are hundreds of foster kids every day that are struggling for adequate care. It's beyond my comprehension that we can continue to underfund that. Hundreds of positions unfilled where foster kids are being serially abused, even murdered, supposedly under the oversight of the state of Oregon. So, Chair, it's astonishing. I'd like to fix that problem.
Thank you.
I think there's no more opportune time than right now.
Thank you. And I should have, before recognizing you, to ask LRO staff to describe the amendment for us so we know what we're talking about. Do you want to do that, or Chris, do you want to do it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the A-17 amendment makes changes to the distribution of the repatriated dollars. So it would set up the first $50 million, it would go to the Department of Human Services for the purpose of stabilizing the Child Welfare Division. The following $2 million would be transferred to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to provide funding for the CASA volunteer programs. And then the remaining balance, if any, would go to the Rainy Day Fund.
Okay, so, and based on, and the other provisions are the same as the A-20? Are they or not?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do have the language changes and the reporting requirement of DOR is also within the A-17.
Okay, otherwise it's the same. Thank you. Other discussion? Let me make a couple of points. I completely agree with Representative Bueller that the funds should be invested in the child welfare system. There are many areas of our budget that I have been saying since I arrived here almost 18 years ago are significantly underfunded. Schools, healthcare, the issue that Representative Bueller raises, and a whole variety of other issues. And it is a these come and go in terms of their need. I'm assuming, without knowing this, that the Ways and Means Committee is struggling with exactly this issue, and hopefully we'll find a way to fund a stabilization of the child welfare system through funds that are going to be regularly available. The problem I see with doing it in this system, in this bill, is that you're dealing with money that you only have once. And in the meantime, you will have ramped up $50 million worth in the Department of Human Services, and then essentially told Ways and Means either find the money in future years or cut something else, which may be equally important, in order to fund this. I completely agree that the needs of our children who are involved in the child welfare system we have is big, is huge, and it needs to be dealt with. I believe it should be dealt with in the regular form, and we should not be foisting future legislatures onto future legislatures increases in a program which cannot be funded in those future biennia. I think the best approach to get to this result is not in a bill like this, but rather in the debate in the Ways and Means Committee about priorities and which items ought to be funded, given the very limited resources we have, which priorities should be funded, and which ones we're simply not going to be able to fund. For every program that we individually may believe is critically important, in order for the Ways and Means Committee to fund those programs, they have to cut something else, which, on reflection, we might think is even more important than the program that that we were putting in its place. I frankly don't believe it's a good idea for us to second-guess them on that. The Dash 20, as it stands, does not have that impediment because it puts these funds into a fund where we're paying off an old debt. And the Ways and Means process and other processes will determine later, in later biennia, whether additional funds that can be applied to that or not. And it won't affect the several hundred workers that we will have brought in and then had to lay off because priorities of the system. I know that this is a cruel discussion that we're having. But when you don't fund basic services adequately, which we have not, since 1993, as a result of Measure 5, you have conversations like this, and you must make decisions that nobody likes. Other debate, other discussion? Representative Hernandez.
So, I'm 30 years old, and I grew up in Portland. And one of the reasons why I ran for the legislature was because I grew up watching people struggle, whether it was through our education system or whether it was with housing, with homelessness, affordability, whether it was with the foster care system or DHS. So one of the reasons why I'm here is because I believed that we needed to find a solution to our public services, public institutions, to fully fund them so that the people struggling to make ends meet or to have the available resources so that they could take care of their family will be able to, an opportunity to be able to be successful. And I believe we had an opportunity to do that last year with our this committees and other folks in the joint committees on tax reform to be able to come up with a larger structural solution to funding so that these institutions have the resources to be able to do the things in which they're set out to do. And this is what happens when we aren't giving our institutions the resources they need. I just came back from testifying on the Senate Education Committee about class sizes. Like, we're at that point where that desperation, where there's so much need and trauma in our schools and we're not meeting their needs. So I think hopefully our conversation can steer towards finding a larger problem or solution to our problems. And this is a tiny amount of money that I don't believe will fix the larger structural issues we have. And I hope that we can also take accountability for the things we didn't do as a body last session that would have provided a good amount of resources for our public institutions that would have done the right thing. And maybe perhaps we wouldn't have been here. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hernandez. Other discussion? All right, so we will need to vote then on the dash A-17, which I think the effect of which would be to substitute for the A-20. Is that, have I got that right?
Yes.
Because it covers the same set of issues generally. Okay. All right, so the question is on the adoption of the A-17 amendment. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Findley.
Yes.
Representative Hernandez.
Aye. Or no, sorry.
Representative
Marsh? No.
Representative Nose?
No.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
No.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
No. Motion fails. We're back to the main motion, which is to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Yes, Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1529, as it's been amended, I want to share with everyone, I support the underlying concept in this, and I think it's important that we have a solid conversation on tax haven status and the repatriation, and it's been great to talk about how we're going to work through PERS and other ways and means issues. At this point in time, I'm going to be a no on Senate Bill 1529 as it's been amended, but I want to share it. As I continue to think through this issue, I leave that option open. But right now, I just want to let you know publicly I'll be a no.
Thank you. Other discussion? Would you call a roll, please? It's on the main motion to send the bill to the floor.
Representative Buehler.
No.
Representative Findley.
No.
Representative Hernandez?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Reschke?
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
No.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. A motion carries, and the bill will go to the floor, and I think I'd better carry it. I'm sorry, before I close.
Yeah, just Mr. Chair, I wanted to let you know, I think there's members on this committee that are considering a minority report on Senate Bill 1529.
Okay.
So I just wanted to give notice on that.
Okay, notice has been given of a possible minority report. And with that, we'll close the Senate Bill 1529 work session. Are we, have we received the paperwork on 1523? For the Dash 8 Amendment. Okay, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 1523. Who's on that one? Chris, thank you very much. Thank you. Why don't you describe for us the bill and the Dash 8 Amendment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill itself you heard yesterday, and it is an extension, a four-year extension of the method by which interstate broadcasters would be apportioned. There were a number of other language changes that many of them kind of codified how these filers were filing in tax years 14 to 16. There was that Comcast carve out, and there were some questions about definitions in those. So what the Dash 8 does is limit that bill. It removes most of that language and just leaves Section 1 of the bill and just extends that this method of apportionment for 2 years. So in Section 1 of the Dash 8, you can see the language where the sunset date is moved from January 1, 2017 to January 1, 2019. And it just took out all of that other stuff where there were questions.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, this was your amendment. Do you want to speak to it?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think yesterday we heard from the broadcasting community the importance of taking some sort of action and giving them some sort of predictability. And at the same time, we heard from the Department of Revenue concerns regarding some of the language, some confusion about some terminology. It was clear to me that we would have to make some significant changes in the underlying bill in order to pass it, and we do not have time to do that. We also know that there are pending court cases that maybe give us some additional information over the next year or so. And so I suggest that we simply extend the current underlying tax collection system for 2 years. That will take care of the immediate problem that we've got right now, because otherwise the bill sunsets in 2017. So we'll be able to broadcasters will know how they will be able to file for both the year right now and for next year. That means in 2019 we can come back and we can have a good calm conversation without the pressure of needing immediate solutions for those tax filers. And I'm sure with all of our heads put together, we will figure all this out.
Thank you. And of course, by then, we'll also have the court's opinion.
That's
decision
right.
On the other matter that we talked about.
We'll have more information.
All right, Representative Smith.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 1523.
Representative Smith moves the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 1523. Further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Smith?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 1523 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves Senate Bill 1523 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Who wants to carry this?
I'll carry it. It's my bill.
Oh, it's your bill. And then Representative Nose will carry. Thank you. I had lost track of that.
I have kind of too.
Representative Nose will carry. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1523 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1528. You want to give us a short description? Do we have the paper, the list of witnesses? And I think, Representative Parrish, this is the bill you're here for. Do you want to come up?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1528. We do a few amendments in OLA, so I'll get to those in just 1 second. But 1528, the B version that's before you, does two main things. There's a piece that's disconnecting, and this is disconnecting from the new federal deduction that was put in place in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in December of this past year, December 2017. But it's disconnecting Oregon from the 20% deduction that's made available to certain pass-through entities. So that's S-corps partnerships, and then also included is sole proprietorships as well at the federal level. So it shows up as, and this would be an addition to income is the way it's written, but really that is because Oregon has that rolling reconnect to taxable income. So to disconnect, we actually add back those the amount of that subtraction. So that's part one. Part two of the B version is creating a new tax credit that works in many ways similar to the film and video. So this would be an auctionable tax credit where DOR will auction tax credits, and then the funds received from that auction, up to $14 million, will go to fund the Opportunity Grant Fund. So DOR will sell these tax credits, and then those funds go to the Opportunity Grant Fund, and then individuals are able to claim those on the returns, or passive entities as well, I suppose, could claim those on their return the following or in that tax year. So those are the two changes in the B version. We do have the B14 and the dash B15. The B14 amendment adds to the essentially to the end of the B version an increase in cigarette taxes. So it increased cigarette taxes by 30 cents per pack of 20 cigarettes. It includes a floor tax, and this would take place beginning January 1st, 2019. And there's also a language that would impose a tax on inhalant form nicotine. So that's the vapor, really, for the more common term, I suppose. And that would begin also in January 1st, 2019. So there's specifications on DOR overseeing that new vapor tax. The B15 has the same language as the B14, only it's a gut and stuff amendment. So it would remove the underlying B version, so it would remove the disconnect from the new federal deduction, and then also the Opportunity Grant Fund auction tax credit. But it had the same increase in the cigarette tax and the vapor tax. And there's also the B18. Unfortunately, I didn't notice that until just before the committee hearing, so that's not included in the SMS. So I apologize for that not being there.
Okay. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under the auction, the maximum exposure to the state of Oregon, as I understand, is $14 million.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
What's the upside potential?
Representative Smith, what we've seen from the film and video auction most recently has they have been selling the full amount of the credits, and in some cases even higher than face value. So you're raising...
So $14 million.
Yeah, $14 million. Actually, a little more than $14 million even. So a little over $14 million. There's admin costs of running the auction and such for both Department of Revenue and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So then those funds in the fiscal impact say they'd be transferring a little over $13 million is what's expected right now. And then again, there is also the opportunity for the tax filer to potentially claim those as charitable deductions on their federal tax return. And that's something we've seen in some cases on the film and video tax credit. But again, that's more between the taxpayer and the IRS and doesn't involve Oregon per se.
Thank you. I've never heard of this term before, so I'm learning something new today. Thank you.
Do you have a sense of what the cigarette tax would raise? I know it's come really recently, but we should have a rough estimate at least available from earlier analyses that have been done.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I should have noted the revenue impact for the 14 and the 15 are revenue light because we did get these amendments fairly recently, and Ways and Means would also be requesting the bills at that point. But yeah, we'd put this in, and I included this in the revenue impact statement, about $70 million per biennium. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that picks up midway through the biennium. There's a floor tax, but in the outer years, about $60 to $70 million is what we'd be expecting.
And it starts in January?
January 1, 2019.
So it would produce a quarter of the $70 million for this biennium.
Yes, Mr. Chair. With the floor tax, we'd expect it to be rounding up to about $20 million.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Parrish, for waiting patiently while we learn about the bill. I suspect you want to tell us about the B18.
I do.
Since your name is on it.
That's right.
Thank you.
And I can even tell you what the fiscal impact is when we get there. So, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin. Mr. Speaker, I just gave you a pay bump. Mr. Chair, I am here today to talk about whether or not we should connect to the tax code for the business type entities that you just heard described, S corporations, LLCs, sole proprietors. For the record, I have been every one of those things. I currently operate my business as an S corporation. I do not currently take the in-state tax deduction that we, a tax rate change that we passed, you and I were on that committee in 2013, Mr. Chair, when we passed that legislation. I do not have any employees in my company, so I do not benefit from that tax break, and that is definitely not what I'm here to talk about. I read a press release from the Senate Majority Office the day that they passed this off the floor, and the headline said, "No second helpings until everyone gets through the line." And I went on to read how they talked about how they were stopping a double dipping on a 20% tax deduction at the expense of everyday Oregonians. Senator Burdick was quoted in this press release as saying, "This is a matter of fairness."
Mr. Chair, when we passed it, the small business tax rate cut in 2013, there was discussion at that time about including sole proprietors or Schedule C tax filers. For those of you who've never owned a business on this committee, a Schedule C tax filing is on your 1040 form, and it's when you as an individual sole proprietor pay for your own income tax to the state and federal government, and you pay to the federal government small employment or self-employment business taxes. I'm not an accountant, just play one in my own business, but I have talked to our former colleague, Representative Ayer, who is an accountant, and I have spent quite a bit of time going through the tax code to try to bring you this testimony today. So contrary to what the Senate Majority Office put out, there are currently in Oregon 192,000 profitable Schedule C filers. These are your smallest of the small businesses. Their average income is about $23,300. So when you read Senate Bill 1828 eliminates double dipping on tax breaks for the wealthy, I would argue those 192,000 businesses who are going to see no benefit from connecting to, if we disconnect from the tax code, and who see no benefit now from Oregon's tax code, will get nothing. So let's talk about who that small filer is. It could be somebody in your community who sells Avon or Mary Kay, or maybe they have a small Etsy business where they're selling their arts and crafts on eBay or and doing some sort of internet business, things to help their family get by. So under the current new law passed by the Congress, how that 20% break works is you take the income on the Schedule C, that $23,300, and then you would take away a 20% right off the top break on the federal taxes, which would bring their taxable income down to $18,640. They've also had a rate change, Mr. Chair, so they would see a little less taxes, those crumbs we heard Speaker Pelosi talk about. They would have a 12% tax rate instead of a progressive 15% tax rate. They still have to pay 15.3% self-employment on the original $23,300 income. No. So instead of having a previous 2017 tax liability to the federal government of $7,333, under the new congressional tax cuts, they are now at a $5,331 tax bill, tax liability. To be clear, we take right now the on the Oregon Schedule C, we come in and we take that $23,000. The effective tax rate for those individual filers is 7.7%. It is 0.1% higher than the largest corporations in this state. So again, Mildred, who sells Mary Kay, who gets $23,000 of income from her business, is paying a higher tax rate right now in Oregon than the largest C corporations in this state. So if we don't connect, her tax bill to the state of Oregon is $1,794. If we do connect, her tax bill is $1,435 to the state of Oregon. It is a loss of $359 average tax revenue, or a 20% tax increase for her if we do not connect. There's a piece of this bill and the underlying bill that passed out, you know, we want to eliminate tax breaks for the wealthy, but that whole tax credit auction only supports the wealthy. There is $14 million in a bifurcated tax year, so all of 2018 and half of 2019, it will cost $14 million to give away those tax breaks. It's a $500 per increment tax unit that they can go out and buy. Do you really think Mildred and her Mary Kay business is going to show up at the Department of Revenue or wherever we sell those tax credits and show up and buy one? No, people who are wealthy are going to be the people who show up. And in fact, there's no limitation. I could theoretically come and buy all $14 million in one fell swoop. And yes, while sometimes people have had the ability to pay more for those tax credits to reduce things like the alternative minimum federal tax, under the new congressional tax changes, those AMT taxes look a little different. We might not be able to sell them at a higher rate. Mr. Chair, we've also sold tax credits at auction in this state for as little as 70 cents on the dollar. So if you take $1 a tax credit, and again, that's not your tax liability to the state. This is how you pay your tax bill. That's really important to understand. A lot of people sometimes don't understand the difference between a tax deduction and a tax credit.
And this committee does understand those things.
So that's helpful.
Let me interrupt just for a second. We have a very limited amount of time
today. I appreciate
that. So I would
that.
Really appreciate your getting to the point of your amendment so that we could understand it.
Yep,
the committee does understand the issues you were about to discuss.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Chair, if you sell that auction a tax credit for wealthy individuals who can go buy it, let's say 70 cents on the dollar, then their tax liability when they pay the capital gains is only 14 and 22 cents at the highest income earner in the state. That effectively makes that tax credit a $3.78 million giveaway to wealthy Oregonians out of the $14 million we're about to appropriate in the underlying bill. I am not comfortable with that. While we're telling Mildred that she's going to pay for that with the $359 we're taking from her by not connecting to the federal tax code. So the other thing I will leave you with is of the $258 million for the rest of this biennium that 1528B proposes, $103.3 million is coming off the backs of those Schedule C filers. 40% of the disconnect cost will come from the smallest businesses in this state. So the Dash 18 amendment, Mr. Chair, simply connects us to the federal tax code. That's it. We connect. And if we want to have a conversation about that 2013 tax legislation, I'm open to the conversation about saying that you can take one or the other and not both. But when you hear that we are, you know, nobody gets through the line and people are double dipping, Mildred not only didn't double dip, sir, she never even got to put a toe in the water, never got to the Walmart to buy a swimsuit so she could go to the party. So at the end of the day, I'm not comfortable with a bill that is going to take $103 million out of Oregon's economy from the smallest tax filers in this state, giving it in a tax auction to the wealthiest Oregonians so that they can buy down their tax liability because they're upset about losing some of their SALT deductions. The last thing I will leave you with, and I know you're busy, but at the end of the day, when you look at these tax rates, and I will get you these numbers and we'll get them up in OLIS so you all have them. The corporate tax deduction under the new tax code still allows C-Corps to be able to deduct their state taxes out of their filings. That it makes, instead of the 21% tax rate that is now the new corporate tax rate in the federal law, it now makes the effective tax rate for a large corporation in the state 19.4. When you add that with the 7.6 state, it is a 27% effective tax rate. Mildred, if we don't connect, her effective tax rate is 30.5. That's what not connecting to the tax code does for 192,000 Oregonians. So I would urge that we connect to the tax code as it stands. We can come back and have some of the other conversations about how we pay for that. I have lots of ideas how to get that done. But again, those are ways and means conversations, so we'll save them for there. But we can do things like fix PERS. You and I were on that, and the courts have said we can do things to fix PERS. We're now spending 33.5 cents on the dollar for PERS than we were when we had that conversation in 2013. We can do things around health care. We had a bill about drugs today on the floor. We could cooperatively bid for pharmaceutical and reduced our Medicaid costs. There's lots of things we can do, but Mildred shouldn't have to put that burden on her back. So I urge an adoption of the Dash 18. I'll take any questions or get out of your hair. You can take your pick.
Thank you very much. Questions for this, for Representative Parrish. Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony. Let's see, Matt Minahan, Anthony Smith, J.L. Wilson, please. And gentlemen, we're on a very tight timeline, so I appreciate your indulgence to keep it as brief as possible while still making the points you want to make.
I'll start. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. As you know, NFIB represents small businesses in the state of Oregon, many being the smallest of small businesses. NFIB is opposed to Senate Bill 1528B for several reasons. I don't know that I could do a better job of explaining some of the reasons that Representative Parrish just pointed out, but I will try to hit on a couple things that she may not have mentioned. One of the things I think is really key in this discussion is that this bill is completely unnecessary to balance the budget. We could get out of here without passing this bill, and we still have $145 million that we didn't know we had when we ended session last year. When the revenue forecast came out 2 weeks ago, the new ending balance for the 17-19 biennium, $145 million. So we don't have to do this. We don't have to make small businesses eat this, and so I would urge you to, you know, make that choice to not do this. The second thing is that Representative Parrish mentioned some of those numbers of the folks who are not taking advantage of the current Oregon pass-through policy. We have about 22,000 Oregon small businesses who benefit from the small business tax cut from the grand bargain. According to the U.S. Small Business Administration, there are 357,000 Oregon small businesses, the vast majority of those small businesses being pass-through entities. So if we're talking about the difference between taking something away from upwards of 300,000 small businesses to spite 22,000 businesses that currently benefit from a policy that we created, I don't think that's good math. I think that's a bad trade-off. Finally, you know, if this is just about revenue, and it's not an insignificant amount of revenue that we're talking about here, the numbers for this biennium, $244 million, next biennium, $376 million, 21-23 is $427 million. If it's just about revenue, then this is a Senate bill that came over on 16 votes, and we potentially have a constitutional problem there. So, again, we would ask on behalf of small businesses in Oregon that you consider not taking action and not moving this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson representing Oregon Business and Industries. Our position has always been full connection to the federal tax code, and we oppose Senate Bill 1528B as it stands. The one thing I want to impress upon a committee is coming from a business background and currently owning a business is that cash flow and retained earnings is everything. If you don't have cash flow, you don't have retained earnings, you don't have a business. And you don't have the public services you want because you don't have employees or tax revenue as a tax revenue dependent state. And so what you have here is an opportunity to increase cash flow and retained earnings in a connection bill that has no revenue impact for the state, either near term or long term. In other words, you have the opportunity to increase small business cash flow, and it costs you nothing. Even the worst-case scenarios said there was a $100 million revenue loss associated with connection in the short term, but we know we've more than made up for that with the repatriation income that we're expecting. And the income in the outlying years shows significant revenue growth stemming from full connection to the tax code. So you have an opportunity to grow small business in a bill that doesn't cost you anything. Now, with respect to the individuals covered by this bill, I do want to make clear and reiterate the points that Anthony made and Representative Parrish made. And I'm just pulling, this is straight from the State Employment Department website, 278,839 business establishments that are pass-through entities with no employees. Average income for those businesses is $47,727. These are far from the folks that you envision as double-dipping in the small business tax cut and with this 20% deduction off the top. So my concluding thought is, if there's concern about double-dip, let's address it. I think we'd be agreeable to that. If there's concern that you want to avoid absurd outcomes, and we'd heard stories about basketball coaches and other folks incorporating just to achieve, then let's preclude that outcome. But you can do that without the blunt instrument of Senate Bill 1528B and still give small businesses cash flow and opportunity in this state without going down the absurd outcome path, which we would be more than happy to participate in that. That's not a problem. So in conclusion, you have my thoughts. We support full connection, oppose the bill as it stands, and thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent iVape, EC Blend, and members of the select members of the vaping community. I'm going to be extremely brief today. I'm here in opposition to the Dash 14 amendment and Senate Bill 1528 that places a tax on vaping. Vaping is a life-saving technology that has been proven to be much safer than traditional smoking. I have personally seen many adult smokers use vaping to quit smoking. It's a technology that we should embrace. With all that being said, we would support some sort of vaping tax if we could sit down and talk about a comprehensive package that will allow some carve-outs for us and to the Clean Air Act and allow us to do sampling and tasting in our shops. And with that, be available to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for business folks. Have you read Dash 18? I mean, if the bill were passed with Dash 18, which is stays essentially still a full connect, would you be in opposition to the bill in that regard?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Representative Finley, no. We would not oppose that version. But I would also say I lack clarity on whether you need to pass that version or just simply not pass the bill. I don't know.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I'm going to take a mixed panel next because we have three people left who want to testify. I think the first name is Nathan, and I can't read the last name.
Nathan Reed.
Thank you. And then Bob Estabrook and Cindy Robert. Why don't you go ahead while they come up?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Reitman. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Small Business Association. The Oregon Small Business Association was formed in 1992 and has more than 8,000 small business supporters. We strongly, very strongly, oppose Senate Bill 1528 for the reasons that are mentioned, and I would just run through them again real quick.
Well, if you're simply going to repeat, I would appreciate it if you skipped it because we're really short of time.
Well, the concern from our standpoint is that the bill imposes a tax on this targeted at small businesses while giving C corporations and other large businesses a free pass. Small businesses are the economic engine of the state, and they're already paying higher taxes. 2016, we got a health care tax. 2016, we got a gas tax. 2016, we got vehicle tax increases. 2016, we got payroll tax for transportation. 2015, we got hotel taxes. Small businesses are already paying higher taxes.
That is a new point. Thank you.
Other key point is that there's no budgetary justification for increasing small taxes or increasing taxes on small businesses at this time. And if there were a revenue need, a discriminatory tax on small businesses is not the way to go about it. So we would strongly oppose 1528 and encourage you to consider other options.
Thank you. Any questions for Nathan? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. We have 18 institutions with 35,000 students. I'm feeling a little bit odd here. This is a simple bill that, in the summary, said creates tax credit for contributions to Oregon Opportunity Grant Fund. What a great thing. That's what we thought when we first saw it, and we're here to support it. I want to tell you a couple little pieces of information. I know you're short on time, sir. Our colleges enroll a diverse student population. One in three of our students is Pell eligible. One in five is first generation. And one in three is from a demographic group that's usually underrepresented in higher education. That said, one in three of our graduates finishes their bachelor's degree with no debt. This is due to generous financial aid, which includes the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And some of our students with the biggest financial need get that money. Unfortunately, only about 8% of our students receive that money. It does leverage about 450% times again the financial ability once they get to the school. But with only 8%, not enough kids are getting it. And actually, only half the kids in Oregon who could qualify for the money are able to get it because the Oregon Opportunity Grant has long been resource challenged. The students who receive it get about $2,250 a year, which is not enough to pay for college. And again, only half the kids who qualify actually get the money. OSA was here earlier, Oregon Student Association. They support this bill because it adds a meaningful net increase to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The state does give money to the grant fund. We don't want to in any way have that decreased. We want to add to it. And in the long run, this is a great way to do it. That's how we do film and video. Why not higher ed? And most importantly, this is a way for businesses to buy tax credits and help pay for their future workforce higher education. So we urge your support.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Bob Estabrook for the Oregon School Employees Association. We represent about 22,000 school workers across the state. I will be extraordinarily brief in recognition of the time. I just want to note, I think it's important to remember that 3 months ago, there were no federal tax changes. And so when we think about what we need to do for Oregon's budget, what we need to do for Oregonians and their tax situation, the highest priority should be holding them as harmless as possible from those changes that really we're still figuring out. And I would suggest that that ties into a value that many of us agree upon, and that is that we need increased fairness in Oregon's tax system. I don't believe that the way that we get there is to make it more complicated, which is the direction that these additional amendments are going. Instead, we would urge you to pass 1528B on. Let's resolve this issue as best we can relative to the federal changes for now. And we are more than happy. We would, in fact, be very excited to be part of conversations about increasing fairness for the tax system for all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1528, open a work session on Senate Bill 1528.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith Warner.
I move Senate Bill 1528B to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves Senate Bill 1528B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, Chair. I would like to move Amendment B15.
Representative Buehler moves the dash B15 amendment. Would you remind us what, Kyle, what that amendment does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, B15 amendment would replace the content of the measure, so it got the underlying B version, and then replace it with the cigarette tax and the vapor tax increases.
And does that include all the date changes? Does that also remove all the date changes?
Yes.
So it's a complete gut and stuff?
Yes.
All right. Representative Buehler, to your motion?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. So I listened intently to your criticisms of my last efforts at trying to provide funding for our vulnerable foster kids. And I do think you had a good point that we shouldn't just fund helping these vulnerable kids by hiring a bunch of people, not have a sustained funding system. Even though I do think it is an emergency situation and we do have a one-off time funding that should go to that. I took your comments in note, and here we have a ongoing funding source to help fund the positions in DHS, which would go to the Child Welfare Division to create funding not only for new employees to take care of vulnerable foster kids, but also to implement the 24 recommendations that came out of Secretary of State Richardson's recent audit findings of the division.
Thank you. Other discussion? We're on the question is it B15, the dash B15 amendment, the gotten stuff. Other discussion on that motion?
How much is 15 mills, Marsh?
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I think this would be a very interesting conversation to have next year. I'd love to talk about it. At this point, I think there is much value in 1528 that we can't set aside. But let's definitely leave the conversation open toward looking at the cigarette tax and trying to use it for some of the important purposes that we know we have in front of us.
Thank you. Other discussion? I'll simply note two things. One is that this particular amendment, as I now understand it, removes all of the date changes that are needed in other parts of the bill in order to keep from driving the accountants crazy, trying to figure out what Oregon's law is versus the federal law. It doesn't redo that. Let's make sure we understand what the amendment does. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. I just want to make sure you're not mixing up Senate Bill 28 and Senate Bill 29. Senate Bill 29 is the base, contains the base reconnection with all of those date changes. And that's what it sounded like you were talking about.
I am mixing it up. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the correction. Now, the problem that I have is that we're dealing with so many issues so fast that I am confusing bills, and I apologize for doing that. May I second Representative Marsh's suggestion that this is a wonderful idea. I've been supportive of increasing tobacco taxes for a long time. I think it's a tremendous idea for a full discussion in the 19th session. I would like the tobacco tax increase to be quite a bit higher than what's proposed in this bill, because our tobacco tax at this point is significantly lower than it is in other places. Two values there. One is it generates funds to be used for programs that we need, including tobacco cessation and use prevention. And it, the simple price increase would tend to reduce smoking by middle and late adolescence, individuals age 13 and on. Simply increasing the price reduces the number of addictions that we will get as a result of that. But I think at this point that's an issue for the 19th session, unless Representative Bueller, you can go to Rules Committee and get them to introduce a bill quickly to deal with that issue. So I oppose the amendment. Any further discussion? I think we better call the roll. The question is on the adoption of the B-15 amendment as a substitute for the bill.
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Findley?
Yes.
Representative Hernandez?
Nay.
Representative Marsh?
Nay.
Representative Nose?
No.
Representative Rushke?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner?
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
No. Motion fails. We're back on the main motion. Is there further discussion on the main motion to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Representative Findley, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I agree with some of the panel discussion that I believe that this bill will put an undue hardship on small businesses. It seems to single them out, and they are the driver of our economy. And because of that, I'll be a no.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's important to clarify what we are not doing in taking this vote. What we are not doing is taking away anything from small business. What we are not doing is making small businesses eat anything, which was something that was suggested in the testimony. What we are not doing is increasing taxes for small business. What we are doing is keeping Oregon's tax system whole. So we got here today because our legislators at the federal level decided to undertake tax reform, and in so doing, they created a very large tax break for small businesses. That's a fine thing. That's their choice. We can't touch that. But what we can do is guard our own Oregon tax system. We are under no obligation to create a corresponding tax break for small businesses, which is in effect what we would be doing if we do not disconnect. Now, certainly, tax breaks have value. Absolutely. There are many reasons to use the tax code to promote certain kinds of business activity. But to do that, we want to have a reasoned conversation about what it is that we are trying to achieve. We want to make objective, thoughtful decisions about that. Now, I think that in future sessions, we should have those conversations. One of our small business folks suggested that corporate taxes in being lowered are now giving corporations an undue advantage. I'm happy to have a conversation about increasing our Oregon corporate taxes at a future time. Others suggested that the Oregon pass-through benefit for small businesses does not go far enough in some ways. I'm happy to have that conversation too. Maybe there are ways that we need to look at our own pass-through to make sure that we are benefiting small businesses. But to simply accept what the federal government has handed us to us and to take a tremendous decline in revenues that would otherwise come to us is a mistake. And again, I would just end by saying we're not doing anything to anybody. We're just keeping the tax system whole. Small businesses will pay the same Oregon taxes this year that they paid last year. And in the future, we'll talk about other kind of changes we need to make to the Oregon tax system.
Thank you. Representative Bueller?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. One of the things that Representative Marsh left out, interestingly, is a big new tax break to some of the wealthiest Oregonians by another complex tax credit scheme, which will bleed off dollars to middlemen who sell these tax credits. So I think that's important that my colleagues realize is also occurring with this bill.
Thank you. Let me just comment on a couple of the issues that have been raised so far. If you look at the tax system in pieces and in isolation, the argument made by Representative Parrish makes sense. If you look at it in terms of the overall impact of the tax system and the overall work that we are trying to accomplish, it doesn't. This particular tax break, the Trump deduction for pass-through entities at the federal level, is an extremely inefficient way to benefit small business. Depending upon the way you analyze it, it's somewhere between 7% and 18% of the dollars actually go to small business people. The rest of the money actually go to high-income individuals who happen to own pass-through entities. 20% of the individuals at the very top of the income range get somewhere between 82% and 93% of the funds, depending upon which analysis you're looking at. That's an extremely inefficient use, and at the same time, you're depriving those funds from the things that we spend the budget on. At the federal level, of course, it's a whole bunch of things I won't try to go into, but at the state level, we're talking about education, healthcare, and public safety, where we spend nearly all of our money, those three items. So this very inefficient tax break, which is being advertised as supporting small business people, in fact supports, gives an unneeded and unwarranted tax break to very high income individuals. That's item number one. Item number two, wage earners who don't have the good fortune or the wherewithal to have established a separate business that they can operate as a pass-through entity do not benefit from these tax breaks, even though their incomes might be identical. And so from a fairness point of view, it is not fair. It is not does not increase fairness. It decreases fairness in the issue. So I'm opposed personally to what the federal government did. We can't do anything about that here, but we don't have to join into it. My final point is that when you combine the taxes, federal taxes and state taxes for people with pass-through entities, those who benefit from the federal pass-through entity, which has been described, I think, fairly completely, will get a net tax reduction, even when you acknowledge that they're not getting an additional tax break from the state of Oregon. And the final point is that the point that Representative Marsh made, this is not a tax increase. This simply maintains the revenue that we otherwise would have expected had the federal tax law not passed last year. Other discussion? Please call the roll. The question is on sending the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Buehler.
No.
Representative Findley.
No.
Representative Hernandez.
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Reischke?
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
No.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Unless someone else is really eager to carry it, I will. I don't see anybody offering, so Barnhart will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1528. Yes, and I'm excusing two members of the committee now because they have another committee to attend. But we, colleagues, we have the information meeting involving corporate transparency, and I'd like to open information meeting now. And we will do that. We have already agreed on panels for that information, so you know who you are. Please come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm very happy today to be here to talk about corporate tax transparency. I'm always struck when I'm attending meetings in this room You know, these are really big questions that this committee deals with. They have really far-reaching implications, and I just really want to make sure that you have the best information possible to inform those decisions, so that we can all be you know, more confident that you're passing good laws. I want to say there's already a lot of information, a lot of corporate tax transparency at the national level, and that's because public corporations report a great deal of information to shareholders and to the Securities and Exchange Commission in the quarterly and annual filings. And what I'm proposing, what I think is important, is that if those same corporations reported at the state level information, similar to what they report at the national level, you would actually have a lot more information available to help inform your decisions and then also to evaluate existing policies. So I have submitted in a testimony a longer report that I wrote on this subject. I'm sure you all will enjoy reading it. It's a page turner. But I'm just going to I just want to touch just on a couple points briefly while I'm here. So. You know, we all know that this, as a state, we struggle to fund, you know, schools and basic services. There's a lot of the discussion about that here today. It's not a surprise that one of the reasons we have these challenges is because for years, Oregon has had some of the lowest effective business taxes in the country. And there's lots of things that go into those low effective taxes, but one of those factors is that as a state, we've given out billions and billions of dollars in tax credits and subsidies through tax incentive programs over the years. And remarkably, very few of those tax incentive programs have ever actually been evaluated. So we really don't know with much certainty which programs are working, which ones are not, which ones should be sunset or extended. And that's a problem. And you know, I think about the Betsy program, which became much more expensive than was originally intended, but because the information about those credits was made public, who received them and who was selling them and buying them, it really mobilized action to rein in that program and stop the bleeding. And you know, right now when C corporations, when publicly traded corporations file their tax returns in Oregon, they report all the different tax credits that they claim. And I think that you should be able to see that information when you are considering extending or ending various incentive programs. Again, we know that right now corporations are bringing home about $3 trillion of offshore profits, repatriating that money. That's a really staggering amount of cash. And that, you know, over the years, Oregon has missed out on hundreds of millions of dollars in lost revenue because of this really rampant abuse of offshore tax havens. We'll never really know what the total is that we've missed out on. You know, I do hope that that some of these recent federal tax changes that are designed to to limit some of the practices that had been in place that were that companies were using to offshore so much money, that they actually are effective at restricting some of those things. But the reality is that those laws are extremely complicated. They interact in very complicated ways with other countries' laws. And so it's really hard to know right now what impact they're going to have. I do know for sure that those same companies are right now spending millions of dollars to figure out kind of new tax planning schemes to shelter more money from state and federal taxes in the future. And I'm not confident at all that just because they got a federal tax cut that those efforts have stopped. So I think it's important that you as legislators, and that we all know, you know, where those corporations are putting their profits. And if they are continuing to shift profits from the U.S. into foreign subsidiaries in low-tax countries to shield them from Oregon taxes, I think you should know about it so that you can take appropriate action to protect revenues for the state. And just one final example I just wanted to mention, it has to do with apportionment factors. You know, for multi-state companies, generally Oregon does not tax the entirety of their income. We tax a fraction that's based on the type of business and the mostly really just on the type of business. You know, this committee recently, and the legislature recently changed the way the apportionment formula for a number of high-tech companies. You know, that's a pretty big, significant change. It was really done without, honestly, any information about what those companies are currently paying, what the and what the impact would be for any particular companies. It's not to say that it was the wrong thing to do, but I certainly would feel much more confident about that decision if we actually had better information available about what they're paying now and what their new bills will be. So because there are rules in place right now to stop the Department of Revenue from releasing information on individual tax returns, in order to have like real transparency around corporate taxes, it's necessary to require corporations to file information not with the Department of Revenue, but with the Secretary of State's office. Since the Secretary of State manages the corporate division with the business licensing, that's sort of the natural place for kind of transparency and reporting to sit. And so that's what and it's important to note that that a law that would require transparency to reporting to the Secretary of State wouldn't actually have to alter existing tax law at all. It could just sit to the side. You'd get the information you need, and you wouldn't have to kind of have to mess with any of the tax laws. And then just in closing, I'd say that I think that Oregon overall is a real leader in transparency. I think we do a much better job than most states at having a lot of great data available on our transparency website. You can look up things like, you know, state contracts and state worker pay and campaign finance information. There's really a wealth of data that's online, and it helps people like me who do research. It helps inform public policy, and I think. Given how important corporate taxes are to our revenue system, I think making sure that information on corporate taxes be included in that, along with these other really important data sets, I think that's a really important thing to do. So with that, I will just say thank you again for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Hauser. I'm a tax policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And we fight primarily for working Oregonians and ensuring that they have adequate services to support their needs. And one of the endless challenges that we face is getting good, hard data on how much corporations are paying in taxes, what types of tax incentives and tax credits they're taking advantage of, and understanding how that interplays with our budgets. Corporate tax transparency is essential to create tax policy that best serves Oregonians and enhances corporate accountability and fairness. Under the current law, as many of you are aware, you don't always have the information that you fully need to really understand what a particular economic development incentive, a particular tax credit, or other tax policy decisions really mean for a lot of the biggest taxpayers in the state, many of which are publicly traded C corporations. A lot of times you'll end up with corporate lobbyists that are happy to share with you their selective version of the profits and of the impacts to their business from a particular tax mechanism. And what we really want with corporate tax transparency is to level out that imbalance of information, to help you all have a fuller picture of really what different tax policies will mean for various large corporations and really understand if it's an effective and correct use of public resources. In my mind, this is a really important mechanism, corporate tax transparency, to ensure that you all are able to fulfill your mission of being good stewards of public resources, of protecting the taxpayers, and ensuring that there are no additional handouts to corporations that are already wildly profitable, simply because you don't have full and complete information on what those mechanisms will mean for them. I think that at a base level, corporate tax transparency is really about accountability and fairness. None of us really know if these large corporations are paying sufficiently towards our shared public services. Some corporations can be paying next to nothing in taxes, paying really a small minimum, despite reporting substantial profits to their shareholders, and could still be asking for additional tax breaks from you all. What we really want is to ensure that there is adequate information, again, for you all to decide if something is really a fair and correct use of public resources, decisions you're having to make every session, every day. And so I really want to help pull back this veil of uncertainty and really make it as transparent as possible what these large and, again, publicly traded C corporations, we're not talking about small businesses here in terms of various other incorporation types, publicly traded C corporations, what do these tax subsidies really mean for them? What are they receiving today in tax incentives that you've already handed out over the years? And ultimately, this information will help Oregonians better understand why corporate taxes as a share of the general fund have declined by over two-thirds since the mid-1970s. And corporate tax transparency will help Oregonians, and in particular this body, understand what changes are needed to improve our corporate income tax system and what changes are simply giveaways to already profitable corporations. And with that, I'd love to take any questions.
Thank you. We have another panel, but if there are questions for this one, I'd certainly entertain them. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
And the other panel, please. As you can see, colleagues, I'm taking my prerogative to tee up an issue for 19 with a chuckle. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Bob Estabrook for the Oregon School Employees Association. On the topic of corporate transparency, I want to share something from my experience. I'm a former DOR employee, Department of Revenue, not speaking for them or anyone associated with the department. But I wanted to share on this particular topic that during my time working there, I worked with a lot of third-party information requesters, reporters, individual Oregonians, the full range of folks who were looking for information from the department. And one of the topics that came up consistently was seeking information about businesses, not just small businesses, individual, you know, sole proprietorships, but even large corporations. And particularly when I would get calls from reporters from out of state and try to explain to them, well, in Oregon, that information is protected, all taxpayer information is confidential, they didn't understand. They had experience in other states where this information is available, this information is posted on a website, it's very convenient. And it really, to kind of tie to a point that a previous speaker made, seemed a little bit out of step with Oregon's general posture towards transparency and making information available. And I think it was awkward to try to explain to those folks why things are the way they are. But from my perspective, I think one of the things that is important here is not just to think about individual reporters or individual researchers and their interest in information, it's to think about what the availability of information does to benefit everyone. Because individual Oregonians may just want to know what's going on with this gigantic taxpayer, why are they so much more special than I am? And I think, again, to kind of connect the dots on some earlier comments, a lack of transparency can make it difficult for us to identify where problems exist. You heard a mention of the business energy tax credit, where there was, I think, perhaps just enough transparency to for it to be found out what was going on there. But you can also contrast this with our property tax system, where there is just more information more readily available than with the corporate tax side of the house. And I think that disparity right there helps to further illustrate that there is a particular spot in our system where we have some work to do relative to transparency, and I think that is particularly relative to corporate taxes. I won't go on at length here, but I am happy to answer questions relative to my personal experience or anything on this topic that's helpful to you.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is Stacey Chamberlain. I'm the Executive Director at Oregon AFSCME. We represent 27,000 public employees and nonprofit workers across the state. But today I'm here to talk about corporate transparency. I think the other panelists that preceded me did a really good job laying out what corporate transparency is, why we need it so desperately. But I'm going to add a little bit to that. It's a lack of transparency that currently exists that challenges our state and places a burden on individual taxpayers. In the early 80s, corporations paid a larger percentage of taxes than individuals, but the inverse is true today, and this gap is growing wider and wider, with the burden being placed on working families. As many of you may remember, last session, there was a hope that we could pull together a diverse table to talk about solutions to our revenue problems. As session moved along, it became more and more evident that certain stakeholders were not coming to the table despite saying they would. Without this, or knowing what these corporations are currently paying in state taxes, or the impact of any proposed reforms would have on them, on these corporations, we saw many questions being poised and discussions had that just ended up in confusion, lack of clarity, and no clear answers. It doesn't make sense to have these discussions in the dark without the whole picture. We do not believe this is beneficial to the discussion and don't see a way to have real reform without this information. We believe transparency and accountability have both we both testified that this is needed for our government to function effectively. When we bargain contracts at AFSCME, we go out and we find all of the research that we need in order for our members to make the best decisions that they possibly can. And this is what we see here. By providing this transparency, this allows you to have the information that you all need to make good policy decisions for the citizens and folks in our state. We know, just as all of you do, you need every tool in the toolbox in order to ensure that you have the facts and the data. And we believe that this does that. And we believe that this tool not only benefits you, but it also benefits policy experts that provide you with some their best evidence of what they think the direction should go, but also the general public, as you heard earlier. It is somewhat fitting that we're here today talking about corporate transparency while we just heard a discussion around disconnecting from the federal tax plan, a plan that minimizes the benefits to working families while maximizing the rewards for those at the top. Many large corporations will reap the benefits from this plan stacked on top of a system where there's tax breaks and credits that we don't know a lot about. There's not a lot of accountability, and we don't really know what the benefits are at the end. We know large corporations have entire accounting departments that look for various loopholes to reduce tax liabilities, and some of them even figure out ways to eliminate their liability altogether. There is an article that came out just yesterday, which I thought was really timely, in the Seattle PI, and it talked about the fact that Amazon had a tax bill of zero in 2017 due to a system of credits and deferments. The article later went on to state that due to the secrecy of corporate tax returns, no one can say for sure exactly how they avoided these taxes, which could have been upwards of $1.3 billion in federal taxes. According to the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, Amazon paid an effective tax rate of 11.4% over the last 5 years. So somehow they were able to avoid their liability. The reality is that this is happening all over the country and has a large impact not only on the federal revenue, but state revenue as well. Unfortunately, we won't know the true and full impact without common sense transparency steps. And I would urge this committee for you to go and look at the OLIS, the reports that we submitted to OLIS prior to this hearing, and the various discussions and the options that we have laid out for corporate transparency in our state. We don't believe that our tax structure is fair, and while we understand that not everybody agrees with us on that, we do believe that people understand that it's more important for you all to have the information that you all need to make good public policy decisions. This is an area that needs to be explored to find ways we can increase information and transparency. We feel that this will lead to better policy and, more importantly, a fairer policy. Thank you all for taking the time to listen to us today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? You did an admirable job both of laying out the issues that you're concerned about and accommodating our time, and I appreciate both. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your bringing this presentation to us today, all four of you. Committee, we are meeting tomorrow on another information meeting. Remind me, what's that about?
I'm using analytics to reduce the tax gap.
This is one of those things that members of this committee need to know about. It has to do with the issue of using analytics systems to gather information to help us to make good decisions about tax policy. In one sense, it's sort of a corollary to the presentation we just had, and there are some new approaches to that, and so I'm hoping to hear from people who are working in that field and maybe from the department too on that topic tomorrow. I'm not sure about the department. They've been pretty busy lately. But please come at 1 o'clock. We don't have any bills up at this time. I would love to promise that we won't meet again this session, but I can't do that because I know altogether too well how things work around here, and there's very possible that there's something that will come by that will require a meeting either at our regular meeting time or some other time. Yes, please, Representative.
Are we done with this informational meeting?
We are, yes.
Okay, then I just wanted to serve notice of a minority report on Senate Bill 1528.
1528, thank you. I was wondering if that was going to happen. Hadn't heard it yet. Representative Rushkie gives notice of a possible minority report on Senate Bill 1528. Representative Smith, please.
You know, Mr. Chair, this may be premature, but we just don't know what will come in the next day or so. But I want you to know you have done an A-plus job as chair of the Revenue Committee. And while I'm still very much a new member here, I'm not new to watching you serve on this committee. And I want you to know on behalf of Republicans, in behalf of Oregonians, and definitely folks in District 57, you've done an A-plus job as chair. And I'd be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to tell you that, knowing that I may not have a chance before the end of session. So.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. You and I have served in the legislature during the same set of sessions. The difference is that you are 22 years younger than I am. And so you probably have a number more sessions to go. I, because of the passage of time, do not. And I appreciate your comments. With that, committee, we are adjourned. See you tomorrow at 1 o'clock.